All right, welcome everyone. My name is Divine. This is going to be the Occupational Medicine Board Review series. This is going to be series one. And for me, my goal with making this podcast is to really help people prepare for the OCMED boards and, you know, from ABPM, really help you understand the material. Because I just feel like my experience with a lot of OCMED material is memorization. And I kind of want to clean that up a little bit. Don't get me wrong, there's things you got to memorize. It's just the same way with every exam. But again, I'm really going to try to help you understand some things and highlight the key points in a way that would really help you remember it for your test. So if you don't know me, my name is Divine. I've made a person that really loves medical education. I have like more than 650 podcasts I've made for the USMLE Step 1 exams, right? You check divineinterventionpodcast.com. I've made a ton of podcasts there, and I still keep making podcasts actually. So, but let's just, you know, settle on a series as well that will be helpful for people taking the OCMED boards. As many of you know, I'm an occupational medicine resident. All right. So today we're going to focus on the OSHA-led standard. Okay. The OSHA-led standard. And, the key thing to know is that this lead standard, right, to kind of start off, there's standards for general industry and there's standards for construction, right? For general industry is the Code of Federal Regulations, you know, 1910.1025. For construction is 1926.62. If you take 26, flip the numbers, you get 62. So basically today, you know that if you're taking the OCMED boards, you're probably going to see a question on lead, right? They love to test lead. They love to test lead, right? And I'm going to try to hit things in kind of an organized fashion and try to make integrations that the boards love to go after, right? So the first thing, let's talk about the regulatory framework. I think that's kind of like a big thing to know, right? So the thing is, again, general industry. When you say, oh, Divine is saying general industry, what exactly do I mean by general industry? Well, I mean things like manufacturing, battery plants, smelters, radiator shops, right? That's 1910.1025, right? But for construction, think of renovating old buildings, painting bridges, demolishing old lead structures. That's 1926.62. Remember, flip the 26, get a 62. Right? The construction standard was actually one that was added later. The first one that was added was the general industry standard, right? And the thing is, in, you know, you may wonder, why did we worry so much about the construction standard? We did because, you know, we realized that, gee, there is a lot of lead paint in old buildings, right? And that was creating a pretty massive occupational risks, right? So around 1993, we added this construction standard, right? So for the boards, know that both of them exist, and you need to know your thresholds code, right? So make sure you have these industries memorized because they can write a question stem on your exams and they'll just give you some industry a person works in. And then based on that, you're supposed to deduce the exposure, right? So don't forget lead smelting, battery manufacturing, recycling, right? Manufacturing of lead pigment, repairing radiators, that's a classic one. Working at firing ranges, you know, like gun firing ranges. Bridges, highway maintenance, right? Construction, especially construction with pre-1978 structures, right? That's something you want to keep in mind for your exams, right? So let's talk about the exposure limits. I think that's the next big thing I want to hit here. Exposure limits, right? Your AL and your PL, your action level and your permissible exposure limits, right? Remember, OSHA does PELs, NIOSH does RELs, the recommended exposure limits, but the ones that are enforceable are the PELs from OSHA, right? Make sure you know your numbers. So let's run through the numbers, right? And I will encourage you to write these down. They will absolutely be on your exams, right? So what's the action level? The action level for lead is 30 micrograms per cubic centimeters of air, 30 micrograms per cubic meters of air, right? As an 8-hour time-weighted average, right? The PEL is 50 micrograms per meters cubed, right? Per cubic meters of air, right? Also as an 8-hour time-weighted average, right? So what does the action level buy you? What does the PEL buy you? Well, the action level triggers monitoring and medical surveillance, right? Especially if you're exposed for like more than 30 days in a year, right? It triggers monitoring and medical surveillance. But if you exceed the PEL, obviously, right, that's a higher number. So you need to do more stringent things like what? Well, you want to do more stringent things like engineering controls, personal protective equipment, hygiene requirements, biological monitoring, and things like that, right? So this is one board trap I think I want to emphasize that people fall for, right? The action level and the permissible exposure limit, they're airborne standards. Those are things that are measured in the air, not in the blood. Measured in the air, not in the blood, right? They apply to what workers breathe, not to skin or ingestion exposure. Okay, so don't forget, you can get lead poisoning from ingestion, right? You know, like for example, if you've worked with lead and then you're eating food and you've not washed your hands or whatever, right? But the OSHA standard is written around air monitoring. That's very important. Now, let's talk about the air monitoring requirements, especially in terms of frequency, right? So the thing is, there's this thing called initial monitoring. When do you do initial monitoring? Well, if you expect, you know, before a worker starts working that, hey, this person could reasonably be at or above the action level, the employer has to do initial monitoring. You have to do initial monitoring, right? Now, from that initial monitoring, if the results come back below the action level, you can stop monitoring. But if the results are at or above the action level but below the PEL, repeat every 6 months. Literally repeat every 6 months. But if you're above the PEL, then you need to repeat every 3 months, okay? That's a classic board question. So, you do your initial monitoring, you're like, oh, gee, the lead levels in the air are between 30 and 50 micrograms per meter cubed. Then you're going to repeat it every 6 months. If it's over 50, that's the PEL, you're going to repeat every 3 months, every 3 months, right? Every 3 months. All right. Now, let's talk about biological monitoring, right? Let's talk about biological monitoring. Again, I've talked about the airborne monitoring for the exposure limits. Let's talk about biological monitoring. Obviously, you're going to be measuring in blood, right? So let's get to the heart of it. Let's get to biological monitoring, right? Again, this is where the boards really love to test you, right? So how do you check these out? Well, you're going to use the blood lead levels. You're going to use blood lead levels. That's the primary biomarker, right? It basically reflects recent and ongoing exposure. That's why we like to use it. Right? Now, what are the critical thresholds you need to know for your exams? Well, the first one is a blood lead level at or above 40 micrograms per deciliter. Blood lead levels at or above 40 micrograms per deciliter. If it's at or above that, then that's going to trigger biological monitoring every 2 months, literally every 2 months. But if your blood lead level is at or above 50 micrograms per deciliter, that triggers mandatory medical removal protection. I'm going to talk about the fine details of that in a moment, right? And then if your blood lead levels are over 60 micrograms per deciliter at any time, that also triggers mandatory medical removal, right? So literally, we'll remove you from that job where you're being exposed to lead. It's like a hard threshold, right? 60 is a hard threshold. So you're like, Divine, you just said 50, and now you're saying 60. Let me tell you something, an easy way to remember this. If your blood lead levels is 60 micrograms per deciliter or higher, you will always be removed medically, medical removal protection for lead. But if it's 50 or higher, you're automatically removed as well if we're dealing with the construction standard. For the general industry standard, we take the average of your last three values. Right? If the average of your last three values, your three last measured lead levels is 50 or higher, then that also qualifies you for medical removal protection. So let's clarify. If your blood lead levels are 60 micrograms per deciliter or higher at any time, you're out. If you're in construction and it's 50 micrograms per deciliter or higher, you're out. If you're in general industry and the average of the last three is 50 or higher, you're out as well. Right. Another thing that also triggers medical removal protection is if the physician says, you know what, seems like continued exposure to lead may be a problem. Maybe you're getting pregnant or you already have like sequelae, like it's like you have wrist drop or whatever. And the physician is like, continued exposure to lead is not a good thing for you. That's another indication for medical removal protection. OK, so again, removal can be triggered one of three ways, single blood level over blood lead level over 60 or over 50 if you work in construction, or the average of your last three of over 50 if you work in general industry. Or if the physician says, you have something that makes continued lead exposure kind of worrisome, right? Now, what's going to be the return to work criteria for these people, right? Well, the thing is, when you're removed, when can you come back to work, right? Because as an OCMED physician, you have to make these decisions. Well, the thing is, the person may return back to work when two consecutive BLLs taken at least 4 weeks apart at below 40 micrograms per deciliter, okay? So below 40 micrograms per deciliter, space at least 4 weeks apart, then you can return to work, right? Now, let's talk about this special thing called ZPP. You hear that word thrown around, zinc protoporphyrin, right? What's the deal with ZPP, right? The thing is, it's like a surrogate for lead toxicity. It's a surrogate for lead toxicity, right? It's a surrogate for lead toxicity, right? Because the thing is, lead, we know, in the, you know, blocks the synthesis of heme. This is part of how lead causes anemia, right? So lead inhibits an enzyme known as ferrochelatase. And what does ferrochelatase do? Look at the name, ferrochelatase. It chelates stuff to ferro. Ferro is iron, right? The Latin word for iron is ferrum, right? Ferrochelatase, right? So basically, it literally incorporates iron into protoporphyrin 9 to make heme, right? But if you shut down ferrochelatase, then ferrochelatase cannot incorporate iron into protoporphyrin 9. So guess what? It's like, okay, who's available, right? Zinc is like, oh, wow, protoporphyrin 9 is hanging around. So zinc jumps on protoporphyrin 9, right? That's how you form literally zinc protoporphyrin. Because ferrochelatase, it's been inhibited. It cannot put iron on protoporphyrin 9, okay? So the thing is, if your ZPP is elevated, it tells us that, man, this person's lead has been affecting heme synthesis. It's a marker of like cumulative long-term effect, not just recent exposure. If you want to know more about recent exposure to lead, the blood lead level is where it's at. But if you're worried about like long-term cumulative exposure, the zinc protoporphyrin levels are very, very helpful, right? So again, BLL reflects current and recent exposure. ZPP reflects a longer window, right? A longer window, a longer window, a longer window. Right? A longer window, right? So if a worker kind of cleans up their lead exposure, this can actually be a board question. What's going to drop first? The thing that's going to drop fastest is going to be their blood lead levels. Their ZPP is going to take a while to drop, right? It's going to take a while to drop. Okay? It's going to take a while to drop. Okay? So you can use the ZPP to see like, hey, what's your compliance look like over a long window, over a long period of time, right? And then remember, under the OSHA standard, ZPP is measured as part of the biological monitoring panel, right? A ZPP that is above 30 micrograms per deciliter, a ZPP above 35 micrograms per deciliter, that's considered elevated. That's considered elevated. All right. So let's just do a quick board style question just to make sure that, again, these things I'm teaching are kind of seeping into your brain, right? So what if they give you a question about like some 50-year-old, you know, battery recycling worker, and you're told that, you know, over the last 6 months, he's had his blood lead levels measured, and one was 48, one was 52, one was 51 micrograms per deciliter, right? And then, you know, it's been measured over the last 6 months. And then you're asked, oh, should this person be medically removed, right? Well, first things first, is this person construction or general industry? Well, I'm going to argue general industry, right? Because the person works at a battery recycling plant, right? And then let's take it, 48 plus 52, that's 100 plus 51, that's 151. 151 divided by 3 is like 50.3, I believe, right? So the average of the last three is over 50, right? So this person deserves medical removal protection. So yes, this person should be removed. This person should get medical removal protection. All right. So again, medical removal protection, I've talked about the criteria for it. And one thing I just want to throw in as a tidbit is that medical removal protection is not just something we do with lead. Another high-yield exposure you should know for your exams that medical removal protection applies to is cadmium. Cadmium, that's another pretty high-yield one to know for your exams, right? So the thing is, when you're removed from your job because you're exposed to lead, because you meet the criteria for medical removal protection, what exactly happens to you? You know, I know you may be like, oh, Divine, so I'm losing my job, I'm losing my livelihood. No, you're not. No, you're not. Actually, according to the OSHA lead standard, the employer must maintain your earnings, your seniority, your employment rights for how long? For up to 18 months. For up to 18 months. So the employer cannot just send you home without pay. No, you're going to keep your job, right? You're going to keep your pay rate. You're going to keep your benefits. You're going to keep your promotions. Right? You're going to keep your promotions, right? So the employer has a few options, right? If the employer can offer you a comparable job with lower lead exposure, they can do that, right? But again, they cannot reduce your pay. You need to keep earning the same amount of money, right? Basically, this was put in place so that workers do not get economic retaliation, right? Because of a work-related biological hazard. Like the employer has to do a better job of protecting their workers from lead, right? Of protecting their workers from lead. Okay, so please make sure You know the criteria for the medical removal protection, right? And then let's kind of talk about pregnancy and the LET standard. I think it's kind of helpful to know, right? It's kind of helpful to know, right? So pregnancy, right? It's a critical board pearl, right? So the thing is, the OSHA standard does not set a specific pregnancy blood lead level, right? But the thing is, NIOSH, CDC, they recommend that pregnant workers should avoid any occupational lead exposure, right? And honestly, the target blood lead level during pregnancy is typically less than 5 micrograms per deciliter, less than 5 micrograms per deciliter, right? So because the thing is, lead, it's a reproductive toxin, it's a teratogen, right? So the thing is, typically, a pregnant woman may qualify for like MRP. You know, if the physician just says that, hey, you're pregnant, I don't want your fetus to be exposed to lead, right? Because remember I said, besides those hard numbers, if a physician says that, ooh, you seem to have a condition where continued exposure to lead may present a problem for you, you're removed. That also qualifies you for medical removal protection, right? So that's something I want to make sure that you know for your exams, right? And again, remember, other things that can make a physician say, I'm going to go ahead and remove you, right, is if you have like renal disease, or you have like high blood pressure, or you have like neurological problems, right? These are all things that lead can trigger or exacerbate. That can also qualify for you for medical removal protection if a physician says so. All right. So now let's talk about the medical surveillance requirements, right? Again, if you notice, I'm trying to interleave these concepts. So you may be like, wow, Divine has said the same thing in a different context like 3 or 4 times. I'm just doing this to help you remember this material better. Right. So, okay. So let's talk about the OSHA LET standard from a medical surveillance and requirement perspective. Right. So again, remember, medical surveillance is mandated when you're exposed at or above the action level for more than 30 days per year, Right. And when we're doing this medical surveillance, we typically start off with an initial medical exam, right? So, you know, we take a detailed work history. Take medical history, right? Hey, have you had prior lead exposure? Do you have any symptoms of lead toxicity, right? We take your neurological history, your reproductive history, your renal history, your cardiovascular history, right? And then we're going to do a physical exam that, you know, with emphasis on the neurological, the renal, the cardiovascular, the hematologic systems, right? And we're going to check your blood lead levels, as I've talked about, your ZPP, right? We'll check your CBC, we'll check your BUN and creatinine, right? We'll do a urinalysis, we'll check your hematocrit and hemoglobin, right? Because again, if we see that anemia, right, especially a microcytic anemia, we're kind of worried, right? Because remember, lead inhibits heme synthesis by shutting down ferrochelatase and another enzyme I'll discuss later known as ALA dehydratase, right? So after this initial exam, right, what are the frequencies for periodic evaluation? Well, if we check your BLL at this initial medical exam and it's below 40, we're going to do a medical exam every 2 years at the minimum. You can do it more frequently, but that's the minimum. But if your BLL is 40 to 49, then we're going to examine you at least annually. Right? If your BLL is 50 or above, that seems like medical removal protection to me, right? We're going to check you a little more frequently than that. We're going to check you a little more frequently than annually, right? We're going to check you like very, very, very frequently, right? Very, very, very frequently. Now, one thing, though, is after you get this initial medical exam, what does the physician report to you and what does the physician report to the employer? You, the worker, and you, the employer. This is a classic thing they love to test on the boards, right? So the thing is, after every medical exam, what does the physician do? Well, the physician provides a written opinion, a written medical opinion to the employer. What does this opinion include? Well, number one, does the worker have any detected medical condition that places them at increased risk from lead exposure? You tell them that, right? So do you have any medical condition that, hey, that's going to put you at increased risk if you're exposed to lead? That's number one. Number two, any recommended limitations on the worker, right? And then number three, you just put in a statement that, hey, you've been informed of the exam results. You, the worker, have been informed of the exam results and conditions of increased health risks. That's it. Right? So again, what are the three things that get reported? Number one, the worker, you tell the employer that, hey, you state if the worker has any detected medical condition that places them at increased risk from lead exposure. Number two, any recommended limitations on the worker. Number three, a statement that the worker has been informed of exam results, right? And conditions of increased health risk. That's it, right? But, you know, confidential medical information, specific diagnoses, no, the employer does not get that. right? So the employer literally only gets the high points, conclusions and recommendations, not the full diagnosis, not the full diagnosis, right? Not the full diagnosis, right? In fact, let's just do a question to kind of rehash this point, right? So, you know, you have a question that they give you on your exam about a physician that completes a, you know, periodic medical exam for a lead worker, right? And this physician finds proteinuria and mild elevation in creatinine, right? What should appear in the written opinion to the employer? Well, the written opinion should basically state that, hey, that this worker has a detected medical condition, because a medical condition was detected that places them at increased risk from lead exposure, right? And then the physician should recommend limitations on lead exposure or removal, right? But the specific diagnosis, oh, this worker has nephropathy. Whew, I saw protein in this worker's urine. No, right? And obviously the worker is going to know the detailed findings. But no, the employer does not get specific diagnoses. Please do not give specific diagnoses. All right. Now, let's talk about the engineering controls and hygiene, right? This is something that quite a number of resources don't necessarily cover, but it's actually very high yield to know for the board exams, right? So the hierarchy of controls, they absolutely apply to the lead standard, right? So let's kind of run through it, right? So obviously, right, like the best are the engineering controls, right? They are the primary method of reducing lead exposure, right? Not respirators, right? Respirators should be more of like a last resort. You should work more at the engineering level to reduce exposure, right? So the standard is explicit. Respirators are a last resort. They are not the first, right? So what are some examples of these engineering controls? Well, things like local exhaust ventilation, right? Process enclosure, right? Doing wet dust suppression methods, right? And also substitution. If the person can work with things that are not, that, you know, accomplish the same task, but do not involve lead, then obviously that's a great thing, right? So if, for example, a task involves, you know, dry sweeping of lead dust, right? You should do, you know, HEPA vacuuming, you know, wet mopping, right? Wet dust suppression methods, right? That's a key bullet point you want to make sure you know for your exams, right? And then one kind of strange thing that pops up on the boards is, it's also important to know that a place that uses a lot of lead, right? The OSHA standard actually mandates that, you know, there should be hygiene facilities and practices, right, that are very specific to prevent workers from ingesting lead, right? So like, for example, an employer has to provide like, you know, change rooms with separate storage for like workload, for your workloads and your street clothes, right? They cannot be stored in the same place, right? They need to provide shower facilities. They need to provide hand washing facilities. They need to provide clean washrooms, clean washrooms, clean lunchrooms, right? So workers must not eat, drink, smoke, or apply cosmetics in places where there is like exposure to lead. They cannot. Right? So the employer must ensure that the workers, they wash their hands, they wash their faces before eating, drinking, or smoking, right? And you may wonder, like, what are these things targeting? Well, they're basically targeting the ingestion route of lead exposure, right? And the thing is, the employer must also provide and pay for protective clothing, you know, coveralls, shoes, shoe covers, gloves, hats, face shields, right? And the employer has to be the one that launders and disposes of these items. It is very important to know you cannot take your lead clothes home. No, right? It's prohibited, because you don't want to take it to your family members and then make them beneficiaries of your lead exposure. No, you certainly do not want that. All right. Now let's talk about the respirator requirements. Right? So, you know, we've talked about engineering controls. We've talked about administrative controls, right? When those controls cannot bring the lead levels in the atmosphere below the PEL, then the employer must institute a respiratory protection program that is consistent with the respiratory protection standard, right? Like the 29 CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations 1910.134, right? So if your, and the respirator standard varies by exposure level, right? So if the exposure level is at or above the PEL, so 50 micrograms per meter cubed, but less than 500, then it is mandated that you get the half face air purifying respirator with a HEPA filter, right? The half face air purifying respirator with the air filter. But what if the levels in the air are between 500 and 2500 micrograms per meter cubed? Then you need to do a full face air purifying respirator with HEPA filter, full face. So if it's below 500, half face. If it's between 500 and 2500, full face. If it's from 2500 to 50,000, obviously it's higher, so you're going to need something a little more intense than that. You're going to need a PAPR. You're going to need a powered air purifying respirator with a HEPA filter or a supplied air respirator, right? And then if it's above 50,000 or the concentration is unknown, then you need to use an SCBA. You need to use a self-contained breathing apparatus, Okay, so remember, again, above 50, less than 500, half-face epiphragm respirator. 500 to 2,500, full-face epiphragm respirator, right? 2,500 to 50,000, a PAPR with a HEPA filter or supplied air respirator. If it's above 50,000, we don't know the concentrations, you're going to use an SCBA, All right. Now, just to add in some pathophysiological flavor with this podcast, right? Like, you know, because again, sometimes the boards, they like to kind of throw in this pathophys, right? So why is lead so problematic? Well, the thing is, lead is a divalent cation. It has a 2+ charge, right? And the thing is, lead is a zinc and calcium mimicker. So many of the things that calcium does in the body, lead does the exact same thing, right? So if you can think of what calcium does, you can pretty much appropriate what lead does as well, right? And then I've also talked about how lead shuts down heme synthesis. That's how it causes anemia, right? What are the enzymes it inhibits in lead synthesis? In heme synthesis. It inhibits early dehydratase and ferrochelatase, right? And that's going to lead to accumulation of, you know, ALA and protoporphyrin in your erythrocytes, right? And then in your nervous system, lead is going to basically shut down like calcium-mediated signaling. Remember, to release neurotransmitters, to keep neurotransmitters moving, to keep neuromuscular transmission happening, neuronal transmission happening, you need calcium for that, right? Lead is going to disrupt that process, right? Lead can cause demyelination. It can impair the release of neurotransmitter. Because remember, calcium comes into the neuron, and then that's what causes neurotransmitter to be released. Lead can impair that process, right? In the kidney, lead can mess up your proximal tubules. You can have a Fanconi-like syndrome, right? Whenever you have proximal tubule dysfunction, that causes like a Fanconi-like syndrome, right? It can cause interstitial nephritis. It can cause a bunch of problems, right? So what are some of the classic clinical presentations you may see on your exams with lead toxicity? Well, from the neuro perspective, you can see encephalopathy, right? You can see like a peripheral neuropathy that is typically motor, especially wrist drop. Wrist drop is the classic one you see on exams, right? Sometimes you may have cognitive impairment, right? From the hematologic perspective, typically they're going to have anemia, microcytic anemia, although sometimes it can be normocytic, right? And typically if you do a peripheral smear, you're going to see basophilic stippling, right? Those basophilic stipples are created by the buildup of ribosomal RNA that is not broken down. There's an enzyme known as pyrimidine 5' nucleotidase that breaks down ribosomal RNA. That enzyme is inhibited by lead. So if that enzyme is not working, you won't break down ribosomal RNA. So it's going to build up. So you're going to have that lead. You're going to have those basophilic stipples, right? And then in the GI system, you know, you can have lead colic, you know, just this colicky abdominal pain, constipation, anorexia, not wanting to eat. And then in the kidneys, right, interstitial nephritis, it can cause hyperuricemia. Because the thing is, when you have high levels of lead, it actually impairs the ability of your kidneys to excrete your uric acid. So you're going to have hyperuricemia, right? Sometimes they call this a sartonine gout, right? And then in terms of the reproductive system, right, lead can cause reduced sperm motility in men. It can increase your risk of miscarriage. It can, you know, increase your risk of a preterm birth as a woman, right? And then remember, what are some things you may find radiographically with lead poisoning? Well, remember, in kids, right, don't forget your lead lines, right? Your lead lines on the metaphysis, right? And then, you know, especially along your long bones, right? Those lead lines along your long bones, those are pretty classic. And then another one you may see are called the Burton's lines, B-U-R-T-O-N, Burton's lines, right? Those are like blue-gray lines along the gingiva, right? Right, although that's a lot less common these days. All right, now how do we treat lead toxicity? Well, chelation, right? So, you know, people that are symptomatic or people that have very high BLLs, right? We can use things like DMSA, right? So dimercaptyl succinic acid, sometimes it's called succimer, right? That's the oral agent of choice that can be given orally, right? What are some other options we have? Some other options we have are things like BAL, right? British anti-leucocyte. Right, it's used when you have like very severe toxicity, when you have encephalopathy. You can also use EDTA, right? EDTA, you know, calcium disodium edetate, right? It's used IV, right? But again, remember, remove your workers from exposure. That's what you should be doing. Save your workers. Remove them from that exposure. All right. So let's just do some quick drills, and then we're gonna wrap up this podcast. Right. So what's the action level for lead? 30 micrograms per meter cubed, right? 8-hour time weighted average. What's the PEL? I remember again, that's 50 micrograms per meter cubed, right? Over an 8-hour time weighted average, right? Remember, those are measured in the air, the AL and the PEL measured in the air. Okay, now what's the air monitoring frequency if you're at or above the PEL? It's every 3 months. What's the air monitoring frequency if you're between the action level and the PEL? It's every 6 months. Okay, now, what is the blood lead level that is going to trigger, you know, bi-monthly biomonitoring, right? If it's at or above 40 micrograms per deciliter, right? And then, what is the single value that triggers medical removal protection? If it's 60 or greater, right? If it's 60 or greater, right? At any time for anybody, general industry, construction, or if it's 50 or greater for a person in construction. For general industry, it's like your the average of your last three being over 50, right? And then what's the blood lead level for which we can say, okay, you can come back to work after medical removal protection? Well, two consecutive samples taken at least 4 weeks apart that are below 40 micrograms per deciliter, right? And then what's that elevated ZPP threshold, right? It's a ZPP that is greater than 35 micrograms per deciliter in whole blood, right? In whole blood, right? And again, remember, for kids, you know, pregnancy, we want to really try to keep your lead below 5 micrograms per deciliter, below 5 micrograms per deciliter, okay? And again, remember, medical removal protection is unique to lead and cadmium, right? Again, we're going to keep 18 months of your earnings, your benefits, and things like that. They love to test that, right? So please make sure you know these things, right? Make sure you know these things. I think I've kind of repeated these over and over again, so this should hopefully be locked in your mind. So thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, I really hope you find it to be helpful. Again, if you're interested in my other podcasts, like my USMLE podcast and whatnot, you can check divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then I also have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com where I talk about life lessons. All right. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in my next episode. God bless you. Have a wonderful day. Bye for now. Thank you.